From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years, and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again, without the constant gain-loss, guilt-virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds, and the incidental carbs you find in things like dairy. Moderate protein scaled to your lean body mass, and then fat to satiety. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. I'll be asking my guests each week what their keto looks like to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we can't give you medical advice. It's always best to work with your own doctor because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. This is the second of 3 episodes I recorded at Amber O'Hearn's very marvellous Carnivorycon earlier this month. And so this week's extraordinary man, wow, that's 2 in a row, is Peter Ballastet. Peter uses his expertise in agronomy to offer an interesting counter-argument to the claim that ruminant agriculture is destroying the environment. Peter earned his bachelor's degree at the University of Kentucky and his graduate degree at Oregon State University. He has an extensive background in forage production, utilization, and forage-based livestock production systems, and was the forage extension specialist at Oregon State University from 1986 to 1992. Peter's personal experience has led him to re-examine human diet and health. What he has learned doesn't agree with the advice given for the past few decades. This new understanding, combined with his forage background, has given him an increased passion for the key to true social, economic, and ecological sustainability, ruminant animal production systems, the source of butter, red meat, and cheese. He is affectionately known as the Sodfather, leader of the Ruminati and the Ruminant Revolution. You can find him on the usual social media platforms, at GrassBased on Instagram and Twitter, and at GrassBased Health on Facebook. Welcome, Peter, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Enjoying the conference?
Oh, it's brilliant. Huge success from what I can see. And we just finished the morning session and learned so much and enjoyed. And I'm thinking about my presentation and how things fit in. So I'm really quite happy to be here.
First ever Carnivorycon. I'm sure there are going to be plenty more, aren't there, by the popularity up there?
I hope so. I could understand why somebody wouldn't want to do it again. It must be a lot of work, but I'm really encouraged by the response.
Absolutely. So tell me a bit about you.
I'm a forage agronomist by training, ruminant nutritionist. So things to do with pasture, hay, silage crops, grazing management. Ruminants would be cows, sheep, goats, deer, lots of wild ruminants, but those would be the domesticated ones people would recognize. So I've had my own personal experience where chronic conditions were reversed as a result of first low carb and then increasing restriction through keto. And now I'm largely carnivorous, not exclusively, although I've given up plant matter for Lent.
Perfect. Why not? Good excuse.
Except for coffee.
Yeah, that's most people's exception, isn't it? Got to just take coffee out of the picture altogether. So what kind of conditions?
In 2007, I was a 51-year-old balding, obese, pre-diabetic. And today I'm just balding. And basically, in 2002, my wife Nancy had begun doing her own journey into low carb. And if you've been around the community a while, you can imagine or remember what that was like in terms of resources. They're certainly nothing like what we have today. But she was studying and finding out what to do for herself. And then it took me 5 years to get serious myself. And then that was almost the time that Good Calories, Bad Calories came out. And I read that book and I started getting angry. I had been out of agriculture for a number of years working in high tech. And I just started looking at what had been done to demonize the product of ruminant animal agriculture. And then I started showing up at metabolism conferences and the beginning low carb conferences. And I've been stalking some of these people ever since by showing up at these things.
A lot of people mention, and I ask, what got them into low carb, keto, carnivore, whatever. And Gary Towser's got to be, that book has got to be one of the top three cited reasons.
It's certainly any of his books, the three nutrition books, are books that I recommend. Depending on how deep and geeky people want to get at it. I've gone through Good Calories, Bad Calories a number of times. I have a physical copy. I have a Kindle copy. I have an Audible copy. So yeah, I'm that guy. But certainly The Case Against Sugar is one to give people to just give them a sense of that nutrition story as well as the politics and manipulation. Because frequently I'll have people ask me, how could we have gotten to this point? Well, that would be a good place to start reading. Just like Nina Teicholz's book, The Big Fat Surprise, would be another one. And I don't mean to slight others. Those are just ones that, for example, there were a string of forage and grassland council meetings in one state. And I was part of that program for meetings, and they sold several cartons of that book, Big Fat Surprise, that, you know, once we got done, I think it was four cartons. So it's good news for people in agriculture because they've lived under this cloud for so long. And those books certainly are ones that I direct people to read.
And you're right. You tend to get a bit angry reading them, don't you? I certainly did.
Initially.
Yeah.
And then hopefully that passes and we try to get to something more productive. Yeah.
Tell me, this is something I struggle with, and I would like to know the arguments and the comebacks for. One of the biggest criticisms and the questions that come my way about eating a fair amount of meat on keto, although it doesn't necessarily, quite often you don't eat any more protein than you would on a standard American diet, for example. But obviously, if you're moving towards carnivore, you're going to be consuming a fair amount of meat daily. And we're told that eating all this meat is destroying the planet. It's destroying the land. The all the methane produced is killing the environment. What's my comeback on that? You know, I have some sort of vague senses and gut feelings for what it is, but I need that expert opinion to slam back at them.
Fair enough. And that's the topic for in a couple hours I'll be talking on. So first of all, I just want to put a marker on the table because the best evidence is that most Americans aren't getting enough protein. Also, we really don't understand protein nutrition in the human diet. People talk about it in incorrect ways. So we should put that off to the side and maybe come back to it, but at least acknowledge it as a reality. But certainly as we eat more animal products, we're not only eating more protein, but we're eating a higher quality protein. So we're getting more of the indispensable amino acids that we need. They're more digestible. So our plane of nutrition increases, improves. So there's that. To the specific issue of the impacts on the environment. My one point is that chronic disease epidemic has an environmental impact. And right now, that's unsustainable. The levels are shocking. 50%+ of adult Americans have diabetes or prediabetes. 60% of adult Americans have one or more chronic conditions. 88% of adult Americans don't enjoy optimal metabolic health. And less than a third of normal weight adult Americans enjoy optimal metabolic health. So all of that has a cost. Has a fiscal cost, it has a personal cost. And it's important for people to recognize that that has not yet been factored into the conversations about societal cost and benefit or sustainability. If health comes in, it's wholly informed by the standard version of what's a healthy diet. So that's critical to know. The cost is unsustainable. In the United States, the cost, the fiscal cost, is equivalent to 9.3% of GDP for obesity and related diseases. That may, in fact, be an underestimate, but it's big enough. We need to make sure that we're looking at those because generally we're not good at weighing complex issues and costs and benefits. We tend to go to the simplistic.
Yeah, just much too of a narrow vision on things.
And oftentimes it's in service of a pre-existing belief.
Right.
Now, I could be guilty of that, so I try to cite sources and things. But if we just look at methane, for example, the complaint about ruminant animal agriculture is that they produce all this greater amount of greenhouse gases than other forms of agriculture. We need to remember or recognize that methane is very short-lived in the atmosphere, on the order of about 10 years before it's oxidized back to CO2. With ruminant animal agriculture, most of the carbon that they're going to ingest in their feed is coming from CO2 in the atmosphere that was fixed in photosynthesis and now is being recycled back to the atmosphere. So it's a cycling of carbon, CO2 to CH4 back to CO2, ultimately, not an enrichment. And the enrichment would come as we burn fossil fuels, because that's adding carbon that wasn't previously cycling.
Right.
So it's a different thing. Also, we need to recognize that the amounts that have been frequently stated are frequently inflated. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. so we have inaccurate numbers being used. We have a misunderstanding or an oversimplification of that process.
You very much have these visions of these clouds of methane being produced above fields of cows. I've probably even actually seen those images somewhere. But
Exactly. Methane is produced from a number of sources, natural and anthropogenic. Then another argument is that, well, look at all this agricultural land that's used for livestock. And consciously or unconsciously, they are conflating agricultural land with arable or cropland and treating them as if you could grow crops on all agricultural land, and you in fact cannot. So the vast majority of the Earth's surface in total, or if you were just looking at dry land, is not suitable for cultivation. If I look at the entire Earth's surface, it's about 4%. And that's probably an overestimation. And we're losing that. We're losing that land through degradation for a number of reasons. Plus, when cities expand, they convert cropland into suburbia. And so we're losing that land. And virtually all of the world's arable land is currently in production of some level. So, in fact, we have far more land available for ruminant animal agriculture than we have for crop agriculture. And then we also need to recognize that it's not either or, that livestock agriculture is integrated into all of agriculture. So if I'm producing a grain crop or a fruit crop or some other commodity, there's going to be a substantial amount that's produced that's not human edible. And so that waste or byproduct can be fed through livestock and produce high quality animal protein and animal fat. And in fact, increase the value of the ingredients going in. So the livestock agriculture, and specifically ruminant animal agriculture, is essential to food security globally. And in fact, if we're going to meet the needs of mid-century, we have to improve the productivity and efficiency of agricultural systems worldwide.
I think that's part of the problem when you said about it's not an either-or thing. I think especially the more moving towards extreme someone's belief are, they make those arguments based on it's either your way or my way. And of course, the majority of the world is going to be somewhere in between. And I don't think anyone, well, it seems to me, no one at this conference or at this end towards that kind of extreme, the meat-eating extreme, is saying that the whole of the world should eat that way. Whereas it seems when you go to the other end that they say we could save the environment by just going plant-based. And so there seems to be that mismatch. I would assume that you would probably say, maybe you wouldn't, but it wouldn't be sustainable to have the whole world on a carnivore diet. You couldn't do it.
I've heard that argument, and you can do some calculations and figure that you could get pretty close. Now, part of this is a matter of improving animal husbandry, improving genetics, agronomy 101 kind of stuff. But a lot of it's got to do with political stability and social progress in many parts of the world where currently they're beset with unrepresentative forms of government, frequent transitions that lead to major upheavals. They don't have the infrastructure. They don't have reliable mainline power distribution systems, and so they can't have the reliable food supply that we enjoy in other parts of the world. And so those are things that people need to work for, just as much as we need to work for safe drinking water, for example. The impact of having illumination inside your home at night and the difference that that makes. There's lots of things that we should be working on. And part of what I want people to do is stop worrying about the things that people so loudly talk about and focus on those things that would make a real difference in people's lives. But no, nobody, I don't think it's, one size fits all doesn't work very well, does it? Hasn't so far. And I would much rather have people understand what some meaningful metrics of health are, how to measure, monitor, follow, and what I might do to adjust those if I choose to. That would be much better than telling people you need to eat 5 servings a day of this, that, or the other thing. But if I look at North America, I think it may be the United States. I'm a little fuzzy. But I'll say United States, we have less than 10% of the world's beef cattle, but we produce 20% of the world's beef. Okay. How could we leverage that more appropriately? Brazil has, for example, enormous resources, but their level of husbandry, for a number of reasons, is not approaching that. So the beef that they produce tends to be much leaner, tends to be of a lower grade than the beef that the United States produces. So one of the ironies is we have people in the United States saying not to eat beef to have some impact on the world, and yet the beef that they're eating in the United States is not coming from those parts of the world where the impact environmentally is greater, far greater than it is in the United States. So you're not going to move the needle by not eating American beef as part of the answer. But again, that's a complicated conversation to have with people.
Is there, in your mind, a good and bad somewhere in between method of producing that beef? So when you're talking about it being a better approach, a better thing for someone to include in their diet, is that a specific way that livestock is farmed? You know, the grass-fed with the nice fields, is the mass production element still a problem?
I don't think so, because I think that's misperceived. So for the vast majority of steers' life in North America, it's on grass. And it will spend 3 or 4 months in a feed yard. Most are going that way. Even there, they're still eating forage. They're going to eat a variety of commodities to provide a higher level of energy so that they can finish their growth period and reach that desired carcass grade or qualities. People assume that, for example, there's lower methane emissions when animals are grazing than when they're in the feedlot. And in fact, it's just the opposite. But we should also say that when properly managed under appropriate environments, and that's a thing too. North America's a big place and tremendously varied environments, and beef is in every state. And so the system has to reflect the reality of where they are. One size fits all doesn't work there either. But even recently a paper showing that beef finishing systems in the upper Midwest, they looked at soil carbon sequestration under an appropriate grazing management regime, and they compared that to a feed yard in the same region. And what they saw was greater emissions during the grazing than in the feed yard. But during that grazing period, the soil sequestration more than offset it. So, okay, how do we balance that and talk about it? And then we have to talk about everything else that goes into it as well. So just to try to unravel the rope and consider each strand, because one of the benefits of the system that we have is that high quality animal protein and animal fat with all the vitamins and minerals in their most bioactive form is incredibly affordable in North America. And part of the message is, if you're metabolically ill, one of the first things you ought to be introduced to is going to the supermarket and figuring out what you can buy from the supermarket you can get to, and how you're going to be able to prepare that and eat that, and what's appropriate to your economic condition and your sort of, you know, cultural background, and all those sorts of things are important. But basically, I want people to feel comfortable going to the supermarket and buying what's available there, rather than feeling guilty because they're not buying some special brand, special label claim, those sorts of things. I'm all for anyone who is trying to make a living in primary industry like agriculture. It's hard. Margins are small. You ask what would be an inappropriate way. Well, if we see long-term degradation of the resource, that's inappropriate. Coincidentally, that's coming from commodity agriculture. It's not coming from beef production. The vast majority of the grain that's produced worldwide is already going to human consumption. It's not going to livestock production. Even a grain-fed steer in the United States, over 90% of its lifetime feed is human inedible. And a lot of that grain that gets fed may be of an inferior grade for human use. So you have that kind of complexity that's adding into this as well. The shorter version that I have is that the problem is not the grain-fed cattle. The problem is the grain-fed people.
Yeah, cattle are much better at turning that into something way more nutritious, aren't they?
Oh, there's all kinds.
Designed for it.
There's all kinds of ecological advantages to ruminant animals. They have this wondrous anaerobic pre-gastric digestive system where essentially they've got this large fermentation vat where this high fiber, low fat, poor protein quality diet, bulky, low quality, gets broken down mechanically through rechewing, that's rumination, chewing a cud, but also this teeming multitude of microorganisms that degrade fiber. Now, cellulose is chemically the same thing, essentially, as starch. The glucose units are just linked together differently. And because of that linkage, no vertebrate animal can directly utilize cellulose as a energy source, but it's the most abundant carbohydrate in the biosphere. Ruminants, because of these rumen microorganisms, can utilize that as a feed resource. You can't feed a ruminant animal much more than 5 or 6% crude fat in her diet without hurting rumen health. But through that fermentation of the fiber, they're producing short chain volatile fatty acids. And so 5 or 6% crude fat goes in. The cow ends up absorbing 70 to 80% of her energy coming from fat. That's remarkable. We just heard that fat is a scarce element in the environment. The other very important niche that they fill is because of this system, the non-protein nitrogen that's part of the feed that they eat is converted into microbial protein. And then the cow essentially harvests all those microbes. So there is no such thing as an essential amino acid in a cow's diet. And so that's really important function in the whole ecosystem as well. There's some others, of course, but those are not well appreciated.
And what about the land itself? I couldn't find the study that my mother was talking about, but she mentioned somewhere in Scotland, I think, they were doing an experiment. She was talking about how it must have been the wild animals grazing were somehow destroying the environment. And they were having areas where they were planting various different new trees or shrubs or things to see which was more beneficial for the environment. I mean, that's completely different when you're raising cattle because it's managed. But what are your feelings about the impact on the soil of raising one foodstuff versus another?
Well, it's an important point. We have to produce food to eat. We can't photosynthesize. We can't eat the soil. So we've got to have some form of agriculture. It's very clear that cultivation degrades soil quality and soil health.
You had some great slides at your presentation at Keto Fest showing the difference. You know, cows put stuff back in, don't they?
And grassland, which is one of the largest biomes, doesn't stay healthy and productive unless it's grazed or burnt. Grass is essentially developed under that kind of an environmental pressure. If we exclude grazing for long periods of time, bad things happen. We build up fuel. We now have vicious wildfires. We have encroachment of woody species in what would maybe otherwise be a grassland and maybe be more productive long term. Those are issues, but the soil health, I think, is an enormous one. And then you have to look at the watershed health as well, because if you have intact, healthy sods in the watershed, you're going to have less runoff. You're going to have less erosion. More of that water is going to get a chance to infiltrate into the soil. So you're going to have less sediment, less nutrient, and other potential contaminants ending up in surface water. So that's all beneficial. There's good evidence that this increase in the organic matter that happens under long-term well-managed grassland relative to conventional tillage. So when I till a soil, I'm introducing oxygen. I'm going to increase the oxidation of the dry matter, the organic matter, in the soil. Organic matter is tremendously valuable for holding moisture as well as nutrients. And the more of the organic matter I can have, the more water I can hold in that soil and increase the drought resistance or tolerance of that soil. So I think the figure is like every 1% in organic matter, I can increase it. That's an additional acre inch of water that can be held in the soil, made available for plant growth. So we have those advantages. I think that there are advantages as well in terms of forage livestock systems, which is ruminant animal agriculture, actually is less susceptible to some of the climate shifts. So if I get a drought during exactly the right time in a crop's development cycle, I've just eliminated the grain or severely restricted the grain yield from that crop. It's a very specific time of development, and you can't make that up. But we could still utilize that. Even that crop still has produced biomass that we could graze, or we could move the animal somewhere else, which you can't do with the crop once it's planted. Or even if it's a hay crop and I've lost a cutting, if the crop hasn't died, then maybe we get moisture later, we get more growth, we could come back and utilize that. So I see forage agriculture actually being more resilient than some of the alternatives people would like to rely on. Another point just to make is that grasslands are based on perennial species and crops are annuals. And it's the nature of the beast that a perennial is going to put more organic matter into the soil, we call it roots, than the annual crop is, because the perennial crop wants to survive for more than 1 year. So it will make seed, but it's also going to try to live itself. So it needs to have a good root system and all that. The annual crop, it's just making seed so that at the end of this cycle, it can then carry on through its progeny, not itself. So that means we're putting much more dry matter or organic matter into the soil that could then increase soil health.
And there are plants often that are mixed into those pastures, like things like clover and things that fix nitrogen into the soil as well, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, so that's critical. Yeah. The whole use of biological nitrogen fixation is, I think it's fair to say that the forage legumes would be a significant source of that. But we keep discovering more and more organisms that live in the soil that do that as well. So the whole area of soil health and soil biology is a fascinating one that we're really having, I think, a bit of a renaissance in terms of new ways of looking at things that we hadn't looked at before. Some people say actually that if you look at a well-managed, high stocking rate, low duration grazing system where you could have tens of thousands of pounds of live weight per acre on for a short period of time, that kind of a system, you actually have more animal biology weight under the soil than you have above the soil. So the bacteria, the actinomycetes, the protozoa, the fungi, the earthworms, the insects, and then of course we've got some, you know, rodents of some kind that would live. So we've got this very complex system in a grassland community. And of course, as soon as we till that, we're going to significantly disrupt that. There are people who suggest that the principle of least harm, which is one that frequently gets used, might actually indicate that we should be eating large herbivores, because we do less harm by doing that than by eating the grain-based or the grain and pulse-based diet that some would advocate as an alternative. Again, everything we do has an impact, and we're not always good at seeing all those impacts.
And these green rolling hills that we see wouldn't be possible without ruminants grazing it and maintaining it for us. But I've heard the argument that perhaps we should be doing without those grasslands and letting other kind of plant life come in. But the point you made earlier about there are potential issues with, potential for fire and all sorts of other things that can happen.
There are consequences. But again, we need food. So if it's not going to come from those green rolling hills, where are we going to import it from? What's that impact? Certainly we can't till those hills, or then they erode and they degrade. On the other hand, there's a lot of people doing work looking at agroforestry systems. It takes a while to grow a tree. And if we can grow trees and grass at the same time in the same area, yeah, we got to figure out how to do that where the trees aren't impacted. But people are working on those systems. Some parts of the world far more than in North America. But the idea that I could plant a couple rows of trees relatively closely spaced and then have a relatively large open area before the next one, and that area could grow grass for a while, and then maybe I could come in and grow some other crop in that space. If I'm growing the grass, I'm going to graze it. Meanwhile, the trees are growing. Those are compelling stories to me. And again, part of this, I think, just like Amber talked about in her talk, so much of what our targets are built on previous assumptions. And part of what I want people to understand is that if the species appropriate diet for humans is higher in animal products, how are we going to produce those? Because currently we're having these conversations that are assuming somehow that it should be no more than 4 ounces a meal a couple times a week or whatever that is. And for some people, that might be okay. I would argue it isn't. But we look around the world and humanity's diet is already plant-based. And frankly, I think that's a shame and a scandal. Now, it's better than starvation, but once you get sufficient calories to avoid famine, now the quality of those calories matter. And the majority of protein in humanity's diet is coming from plant sources. And it's miserable quality protein. It's not sufficient to support human flourishing. And one of the ironies that people need to understand is that if your primary motivation or primary value is to limit, you can have one of two. You can be most concerned with limiting human impact, or you can be most concerned with maximizing human flourishing. And if you pursue maximizing human flourishing, you will get to minimizing human impact. But if you start with the minimizing human impact, you won't get to maximizing human flourishing. We've seen major improvements in the living conditions of humanity worldwide, not to minimize what still needs to be done. But if your interest is in bringing down birth rate, for example, the best way to do that is to increase human flourishing. And it's only prosperous societies that can afford to worry about conservation. You know, if you're starving, you have one problem. Just one. And it doesn't matter. Wildlife, you bet, that'll do. If I have to, denude the hill lands to get something to cook with, right? So I'm going to strip off all the green bits. That's going to have an impact. It's also going to produce a lot of particulate pollution inside the home. So now we've got respiratory problems. All of these things are interlinked, and we should be working towards improving the conditions of our brothers and sisters worldwide. So part of my vision that I hope I can get people to see is the need to pursue what I call a ruminant revolution, just as we needed the Green Revolution. When that action averted famine and starvation for a billion people, when that was a quarter of the world's humanity, today we need a ruminant revolution to enable the prosperity and the flourishing for humanity. And I think we're hearing all the news about ruminant animal products are fundamental to properly nourished brains. And whatever problems we're going to face have to be solved by well-nourished brains that are communicating with each other. And the more brains we have, communicate, that's a good thing. So I want people to have a sense of hope. I want people to not listen to the voices that want to make them feel guilty. Understand where those voices are coming from. That might help. Understand some of the contradictory information or alternative information to what we frequently hear. But most of all, I want people to pursue improving their own health, because I'm convinced that when we improve our own health, we are improving the world. And that, in the end, may be the thing that we can do. And certainly we have our own personal experience, then we see what that does with our families, with our acquaintances, then we start thinking of how we can do this within our communities. We start thinking bigger. Then we start thinking, how can this be applied to what I do? And those sorts of things. I see that as what's going to produce the sorts of change that we need.
Yeah, getting ourselves well so that we can give back and make those changes that we really need. Yeah, I love that holistic approach that you take. Where can we read more, find out more about you, your website, etc.?
You can find me all over social media. Look for Grass-Based, one word, on Twitter and Instagram. Grass-Based Health is a Facebook page. You can find me on YouTube just by looking for Peter Ballerstedt. And then you can feel free to contact me through those or email me through peter.ballerstedt@gmail.com.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me today. Perhaps you could leave us with a top tip.
Top tip? The secret to enlightenment is to lighten up. So a steak a day keeps the doctor away.
And that's from the sod father himself. See how you've earned that moniker now.
Join the Ruminati. Join me in the Ruminati. Help forward the ruminant revolution.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Likewise.
To get the resources and links from the show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you want to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. If you fancy joining me on this exciting adventure and want to help me create new episodes, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Women Podcast website. Please help other people hear about and find this podcast by reviewing the show on my Facebook page and iTunes or whichever podcast app you use. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support means the world to me. Thank you. This week's end quote is a little bit of a silly one, but it did make me chuckle. It's from Tom Snyder. If we're not supposed to eat animals, how come they're made of meat? Bye-bye, keto lovelies.